Welcome back to Murderland Chicago, a deep dish of death. This is part two of our John Wayne Gacy conversation. In our last episode, we set the stage for how Chicago's ethnic, religious, and political landscapes shaped Gacy's personality and motivations and helped him to go undetected for several years. For those of you who are social workers out there, we Hibsied him. We wanted to see his human behavior in the social environment and came away with four human faces of Gacy. Gacy as a Polish American, Gacy as a Catholic, Gacy as a political animal, and the last one is probably the one that's going to be the most useful for us to look at today, Gacy as a gay man / cruising Gacy. And we have a quick correction to make from the previous episode. The neighborhood where Gacy lived is currently called O'Hare, not Norwood Park or Norridge. The airport is also within the boundaries of that neighborhood. In our defense, these three places are all very close to each other on the map. Today, we're going to go away from the social work class. We're going to go away from Hibsy and Gacy, and we're going to talk about the victims, including why so many young men and boys went missing without any repercussions. The locations that Gacy was known to cruise for sexual partners and for victims, and the long-term impact that these crimes have had on Chicago. As we said before, we want to make sure that we're talking about Gacy in a holistic way. Chicago created the conditions for him to be able to find these victims. These locations that he went to were not created by Gacy. They were created by Chicago after decades of history, or even centuries of history in some cases, that led him to those places. So let's get into it. Meredith.
All right. So now we are back in 1970. After getting paroled, Gacy fled Iowa and established a mainstream public life in Chicago by buying a home, marrying Carol, launching a successful contracting business, hosting massive backyard parties for his neighbors, and being active in the local Democratic Party. The contracting business gave Gacy access to lots of young men and teen boys because he was always offering a job. During this time, Gacy also established a private life within Chicago's burgeoning gay cultural revolution, and he took advantage of cruising culture to have frequent anonymous encounters with young men and teen boys. Not all of these encounters were fatal, but they were violent. As we'll see throughout this episode, Gacy's diligence in keeping up appearances in his public life helped him to avoid the consequences of his private activities on more than one occasion prior to his arrest in 1978. All right, so on New Year's Day of 1972, Gacy committed his first known murder. While out cruising on New Year's Eve, Gacy picked up 16-year-old Timothy McCoy at the Greyhound station and brought him home to spend the night.
Chicago, even though we are a wintry tundra for the majority of the year, okay, for some reason, we are also a gay mecca for the Midwest. And people leave their dairy farms, right, and come straight to Chicago, which has, it continues to this very day, the largest LGBTQ population in the Midwest, right? The poem goes, this is like right after the infamous opening, Hog Butcher for the World, whatever, whatever.
Yeah.
It says, "They tell me you are wicked, and I believe them, for I have seen your painted women under the gas lamps, luring the farm boys." And I always think about that fucking line, right?
Yes.
Because in a lot of ways, Chicago was a sin city and continues to be to this day, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the reason why Al Capone had his empire in Chicago, right?
Yes.
So what we need to remember is that when you're a farm boy in the middle of Iowa, right, if you're going to want to sexually explore, you're going to come to Chicago, probably via Greyhound, right?
Yes. Now, at this time, the Greyhound bus station was located in the Loop, right at Clark and Randolph, kind of near where the Thompson Center stands today. This is a 2-minute walk from the Chicago Picasso. In the 70s, downtown Chicago was largely viewed as a crime-ridden zone after the workday was over. Like we talked about when we covered Brian Dugan, people would work downtown and commute to the suburbs like Naperville and Lyle, And the Greyhound station at this time was a rundown, depressing, kind of abandoned place. The Chicago Tribune even published a review of the station that described it as a place for rapists, pickpockets, and vagrants. But of course, travel by bus was, and still is, one of the least expensive ways to travel in this country, and Timothy in particular was on his way from visiting relatives in Michigan back home to Iowa. The 16-year-old kid from Iowa was in Chicago overnight for a long layover, and he was facing the night alone when Gacy came along and put on his jovial Chicago uncle act.
Meredith, I recently did take a bus. I had to get from Dallas to McAllen, okay? Mm-hmm. And when I was looking up flights during that time, the cheapest flight was like $900, which is like unheard of, right? So I looked up good old Greyhound. I basically was able to get a really cheap ticket that went from Dallas to San Antonio, and I had a layover in San Antonio, right? I get to San Antonio. It's been a harrowing fucking ride, right? For anyone who doesn't know, I've been trying to give up smoking for the past 20 years of my life. But today was one of those days where I was like, you know what? I deserve to relapse. So I'm outside and I bought cigarettes and I forgot, smoker 101, you need to have a fucking lighter, right? So I go outside and there's a dude just waiting outside of the bus station, right? And, you know, he's like leaned up against a car and he's smoking a cigarette. So I go up to him, I have my backpack on, you know what I'm saying? And like, hey, you know, do you happen to have a light, right? So he gets a lighter out of his pocket and he looks at me. He's like, are you hungry? And I said, no. Anyone that knows me knows that I look pretty well fed most days, you know? But then I realized he's there cruising, right?
Oh.
He's there to probably pick up random dudes, right? They come out of the bus station. And I think that what he thought I was doing when I went to go ask him for a light was actually to initiate a conversation that would lead to, you know what I'm saying, like some hot man-on-man anonymous sexo, right, in San Antonio. It didn't. But it reminds me just of like how, yes, this type of Greyhound America, right, that we're talking about, you know, yes, it happened in the 70s. It's still happening today, right? And I think what you're talking about here, especially with how downtown Chicago was, people don't even realize that there was a time that you never went downtown.
The only times I was ever down there was on school trips to go to a museum.
Yeah.
I started going down there, I think, first year of college. And I realized that it was a completely like new part of the city for me.
Yeah.
By that time, we're talking about the early 2000s, a lot of development or investment had been made in that downtown area. And it was not the place of our childhood.
No, if you're Gen Z, you have no idea that Chicago downtown was an undesirable place. But back to Gacy, who knew very well and loved the fact that downtown was seedy as all fucking hell. So what happens then after he meets Timothy?
So he takes him home, and in the morning, he kills him. And then once he kills Timothy, Gacy buries Timothy in the crawl space under the house. And only years later would Timothy's remains be identified through dental records.
A lot of my research came from the Sam Almirante book, and I didn't say who he was during the last episode, but Sam Almirante was basically the celebrity lawyer that defended Gacy and basically did it all because he wanted to write a book about him because he knew it was going to sell. He's just a sleazy lawyer, right?
Yeah.
According to Sam, there's like a couple of versions of what happened here, but they both lead us to the same place, right? One stream is that Gacy thought that Timothy was stealing from him, right? That so they hook up, you know, like he's over at this guy's house. Let us also make sure that we remember that Timothy is 16 years old, right? And Gacy's in his 40s, right? But
no, oh wait, no. He was 36 when he was captured in 78.
I guess I'd never done the math before, but okay, so yeah, he's in his 30s. Still creepy, right? But basically, Timothy, he's out and about in his house, and Gacy doesn't know why, because Gacy's just like wakes up in bed by himself, hears some rustling, right? Comes downstairs, assumes that Timothy is trying to steal from him, right? And basically kills him in self-defense. That's one stream, right? The other stream starts similarly, but actually is that Timothy is making him breakfast. And that he's in the course of kind of like chopping up some veggies for a Denver omelet, right? And that Gacy walks in, sees him with a knife, and thinks, oh, this dude's trying to kill me, takes the knife, and kills him, okay? Both of these I hate because we don't know what actually happened, right?
Yes.
Gacy is a malignant narcissist, right? And we don't know, we can't trust anything he says. And also, this kid is 16, right? So any version, right, that, you know, tries to exculpate Gacy in any way is automatically stricken in my book, right?
Yes.
Because the boy is 16 years old, right?
He has no agency.
No agency whatsoever, right? And both of those versions are equally sad. If he's trying to steal just to, like, get, like, some money to go home, that's horrible. If he's trying to, like, make breakfast and play house with Gacy, that's also equally sad because, you know, you need to love yourself. You know what I'm saying? But regardless of what sad stream we get to, we go down, we get to the same fucked up place, which is that Gacy confesses that when he kills Timothy McCoy, it gave him a, quote, mind-numbing orgasm, unquote. The murder had allegedly been a mistake, but it instilled in Gacy the ultimate thrill that he would crave for the rest of his life. But this is a trend that we see over and over again with sexual killers and psychopathic sexual sadists.
Let's also talk about young men traveling alone and the risk factors that they face. You described your travels on the Greyhound through San Antonio as an adult, kind of intimidating man. Like, I don't think people are going to, like, come up and mess with you. And it was still sounded to me kind of harrowing.
You know, in my particular case, you know, I don't get cruised a lot, right? Because I usually look angry. But if I were to invite, right, you know, like, I think in the instance of the Greyhound bus, when I went up to someone to ask them for a light, right, that's kind of like the in that people are looking for, right? Some common things that people do, you know, like, they'll tap their foot in the bathroom, or they'll just kind of, like, take their toilet paper, and they'll, like, let it go down below the wherever the wall is.
The divider.
The divider, yeah. That's a sign, right? So people are all kind of, like, waiting for this opportunity to strike, right? And I don't want to put it in, like, because listen, there probably right now as we are talking, there are millions of gay men getting each other off in some type of anonymous hookup spot worldwide, right? And the vast majority of them are doing it in very normal and healthy ways, right? But Gacy was able to utilize the anonymity of that to his benefit, right? Because he had learned how to do this, because he had learned kind of the tricks, he had learned how to tap your foot, how to kind of like hang your toilet paper, all these things aided him in being able to access this population that was ripe for victimization. Because, as you mentioned before, and that stuck with me ever since, you know, you said there must be a lot of trust in the gay community, right? And you know, that stuck with me because it is trust, but it's a weird trust. There is a place of vulnerability that you are placing yourself in actively when you're hooking up with someone, right?
Yeah. Well, and there's also, let's say that Gacy was putting out the signs and Timothy was picking them up. We're also assuming he went along willingly because we don't know.
Yeah.
But if we assume that he went along willingly, he's looking to Gacy, who at that time is 30 or early 30s, to be a teacher.
Yep.
Right? Is he reading the signs correctly? If you do this, what kind of reaction are you going to get?
Yeah.
You know, is this person presenting in a trustworthy manner? And 16-year-olds' radars for adults acting in a trustworthy manner is off in the best of circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just really easy to see how he got ensnared and just really, really tragic.
Yeah.
Timothy wasn't identified until years and years later when dental records were matched, and there are still 5 victims that have not been identified. So Chicago and the cruising culture that was and still is apparent here helped keep those victims anonymous, and so that really just helped Gacy act freely.
Yeah, so I think that you bring up such a good point because there is a, I want to call it a misunderstanding, I think, amongst a lot of people when they talk about Gacy and these individuals, that because we don't know their identities, that they were somehow runaways, or that they, you know, didn't have families, etc. And I think Timothy is a really great example of the fact that Timothy did have a family. Mm-hmm. Timothy was not a kind of unknown street kid. I don't know why the media likes to kind of hone in on that idea. The reason why many of these victims remain anonymous is because the meeting point with Gacy was anonymous, right? So there's no lead up. There's no way for you to kind of get to that place. And because of that, it's so difficult for you to identify them, because they've cleared the search browser, basically, right?
Yeah. Yes.
By accessing an individual in a place that's made for anonymous meetings, right? Mm-hmm. So we're not talking about situations in which Gacy, like, was trying to find people that were completely, you know, cut off from their families. We're potentially looking at people like Timothy, who were being cut off from their families momentarily, and took advantage of that opportunity to do something anonymous, and then were unfortunately ended up in the snares of a monster.
Yeah. One thing that I've been thinking about while we were putting together this episode is that a lot of the timeline of when Gacy was active is overlapping with this month. We're recording in the month of December.
Oh, wow.
Gacy murdered Timothy New Year's, and then later in 1978, when he was eventually caught, it was December. I thought it would be easy to put myself in the shoes of victims, and what is the situation on New Year's when the 16-year-old kid is maybe huddled over and it's freezing in the Greyhound station? But then I realized I can't, because of global warming.
Oh.
We are projected to have Christmas Day be a high of 57 degrees.
Oh, wow. Okay. So for all of our listeners out there who are Gen Z and younger, Chicago used to be cold in the winter. Chicago used to be very good. We were known for being cold. So you do have to go back to what the situation would have been pre, you know, excessive global warming in the 1970s. It would be freezing cold outside.
It would be freezing cold. You've got a 16-year-old in the middle of Chicago, doesn't know where to get a bite to eat. Probably walked outside the Greyhound station, saw a bunch of nothing, and ran back inside. And all of a sudden, you've got an adult man saying, "Are you hungry?"
Yeah, that's probably what happened. I mean, and I'm glad we're doing this for a number of reasons, but just being able to kind of like put that visual out there, that it was a barren wasteland, and him being from Iowa and coming back from Michigan, he probably was excited about going to Chicago, thinking, "I'm gonna go outside and see all this like cool stuff," and da da da. And you get there, and who hasn't had that experience where like you have like an unfortunate layover somewhere and think, "Oh, cool, I'm in Tallahassee. I'm gonna go live it up for 3 hours," and realize, "Oh shit." I don't want to go anywhere here. I'm just going to stick to this Applebee's, right? But I mean, this is the same experience that Timothy's having, right? He's going outside. Yes. He's looking around. And he's like, "I can't, you know, this is unsafe," right?
Yes. He knows enough to know that that's unsafe. He just doesn't know enough to spot Gacy as a monster.
Yeah.
So fast forwarding a little bit to after New Year's, after that murder, I wanted to note that the house on Somerdale Avenue did not have a basement. So the crawl space where Gacy put all of these bodies is actually right under the living area of the home. So that means when Timothy's body began to decay, the whole house began to smell. And I just want you to like have that in your mind. Later that year, July of 1972, Gacy gets married to Carol. So this first murder happened before the marriage. So he brings Carol and his two stepdaughters into the home, and Carol immediately complains about the smell.
First of all, just as a Chicagoan, when someone tells me that a house has a crawl space, I think to myself, wow, that must be a really new house, right? Because Chicago is where the basement is king. And if you are listening on one of the coasts, you probably don't even know what a basement is, right? Basements are something that Chicago homes are all supposed to have, right? Because we have tornadoes, right? But yeah, and the other reason too, flooding, right? The reason why you have a basement in Chicago is because we get an insane amount of rain, right? And if you just have a crawl space under your house, you're going to get flood damage, right? And I think this is, brings us to reason number three why you don't have a crawl space. We have tons of random ass animals in Chicago, right? That love to crawl under houses and die, right? And I know myself of many friends that had raccoons die under their house, or, you know, had like a rat die in there somewhere in their car engine, and all of a sudden, like, everything smells in their car, right? So, you know, we're going to go more into who Carol was and some of the issues there, right? But I don't 100% blame her, although that smell must have been horrible because it was thawing out in June, right?
So, like, fast forward a little bit. In at least one jailhouse interview, Gacy claimed complete innocence here. And he insisted that the odor in the home was due to that consistent post-rain flooding that be under the house, right? So it's, that is plausible. And this is must have been like one of the things that he told Carol, and he told his stepdaughters and all the neighbors, because even after the murder started, Gacy did not stop hosting parties at his home. And all of the neighbors knew that the Gacy home smelled bad. Let's also talk about Midwestern nice. And for those who might need a definition because you've never heard of the Midwest or met one of us, this is the understanding that you should be kind to people regardless of the circumstance and that you should repress the urge to speak ill of anybody. This means politeness reigns supreme even when you're uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And now, like, I just want to, like, make it crystal clear. Unless you're a native speaker of Midwestern nice, it can be an opaque and unnavigable social situation. So when I hear that the neighbors knew about the stink but didn't raise an alarm, that tells me that they were all doing their very best to mind their own damn business, and nobody was out there being Karen.
Yeah, because being a Karen is kind of the antithesis of Midwestern nice. Because I think people in the coast usually just lump the South and the Midwest together, right?
What?
This is my experience.
We sound completely different.
But that kind of, like, bless your heart, that kind of, like, that I'm telling you that you're wrong, but I'm not telling you that you're wrong. That's not Midwestern nice. Midwestern nice is that I'm not saying anything. That I'm completely ignoring all the red flags, right, as a sign of social courtesy, right? I've heard a lot of people talk about kind of the origins of Midwestern nice coming from this kind of very, like, Lutheran, Scandinavian culture, right, which I think is interesting, right, because it definitely comes from somewhere. Right.
Yeah.
And it is very much something that exists. It's probably something that also causes a lot of anxiety in all of us because no one tells us, right, when there's something wrong. Right.
You just have to be able to intuit it from the signs and the silences.
And the silence, right? And so you have to be kind of like a good interpreter of silence, right? To figure out what did they just go silent a little bit before they were supposed to? Because that might mean that I have a bunch of tapioca stuck in my beard from lunch, right? I speak from personal experience, right? But these are the situations that can arise. And so I think you're 100% right. The fact that he is having these parties at his house, right? And the people are still going there, you know, very commonly, Midwestern nice experience, you go in someone's car and it smells, right?
Right.
And you're told not to say anything about it, right? You're supposed to pretend like, you know, you have no idea what the hell's going on. You might say something like, hey, I'm kind of hot, can we just crack open a window? You know what I'm saying? Like, you might say something like that, but
and that's very bold. That is exactly how you tell somebody that their car smells.
That's the boldest you can go, right? I'm gonna argue. And you know, I know that I used to have that experience going into people's houses and they would smell and you wouldn't say anything, right? So
yeah, because it's fucking rude,
it's
right?
Rude. Like, so when we take that kind of cultural phenomenon, right, I also think that this might be one of the reasons why Chicago was such a hotbed and continues to be such a hotbed of serial murder and murder in general, because old school Chicago etiquette is to not say anything, right?
Yeah.
And because you're not saying anything, you are being willfully blind to something that might be extremely dangerous.
Yeah. And I'll build on that. One thing that helps people as social creatures solve problems is talking about those problems, yeah, or even just talking about anything, because you can make connections just because somebody happens to mention something that you were thinking about.
Yeah.
Not saying anything and keeping your mouth shut and minding your own business made sure that maybe no real conversations were being had that would have helped people put two and two together.
Yeah.
So you've got a bunch of individuals saying like, oh, bad smell. And then that's where the thought stops.
Yeah. So hot take here, Midwestern nice, over. We're over it. Yeah.
All right. So in 1972, as far as we know, kicked off a 6-year period of abduction, rape, torture, and murder that kicked into high gear as soon as Carol divorced Gacy, took the kids, and moved out.
Yeah, a situation which, again, when we look at the four faces of Gacy, this is gay Gacy coming out to play, and 100% a situation that we see to this very day from guys that come out of the closet late in life. You know, for, I want to say 40, but he's not even 40, right? For the majority of their lives, right? They've been jerking it in the basement on a private browser, right? And now they buy the assless chaps and they're sucking dick like there's no tomorrow because they feel like this is their sexual liberation. I will say that as an adult gay man that came out as a teenager, it makes for some really awkward situations. And especially with, this is going to be a little bit of a tangent, but I think it's applicable here, right? You know, when you take older men who have never been in relationships with other men before, they are emotionally a teenager, okay? Mm-hmm. And so the way that they date other men is going to be, they're going to revert back to a teenager self because they have no idea how to process those emotions. And for many of us who are sitting in our 30s or, you know, older, right? And we look back on our relationships, those relationships really should be seen as almost like training courses for where we are today, right?
Yes.
Because we really learn how to deal with our emotions in ways that hopefully are going to be progressively less toxic and less pathological as we progress. But when you see guys in their 40s who are coming out late, they haven't been through those training courses, right? So they're starting at ground zero. Put a teenager into a 40-year-old's clothes, and that's basically what you're seeing. So it comes off being very stilted, and probably what we saw with Gacy.
Okay. Some survivors, including former employees of Gacy's contracting business, did come forward with their accounts of their encounters with Gacy. By and large, however, these victims were ignored or disbelieved. Gacy was shrewd enough to prey on the kind of people that don't have clout. These are gay sex workers, teens from less privileged backgrounds, and I don't really mean disadvantaged here, I mean teens from regular Chicago families that simply hadn't meticulously cultivated clout or wealth. And also young men who were called transients, meaning that they were traveling through town for whatever reason, therefore far from home and vulnerable. Gacy knew that his word counted more, and he even told one of the survivors as much, saying that no one will believe your story after he let a victim go after an entire night of torture.
I think you raise such an amazingly important point here, which is that when we talk about them being less privileged, I think that where people's minds go instantaneously is that they come from very poor families that have, you know, like no resources whatsoever. That's not what we're saying here. This is a very much of a relational privilege, right? They are less privileged because of how much privilege Gacy is exercising in Chicago, right? And again, talking about Chicago as a universe, right? The fact that he is a precinct captain, the fact that he is an upstanding member of probably the Chamber of Commerce and the JCs and all this other stuff, right? You know, that makes him someone who has clout in Chicago. And Chicago is the capital of clout, right? If you're able to have clout in Chicago, you're able to basically, and as we see here, get away with murder.
Yeah, exactly. And these survivor accounts are how we know how Gacy lured and ensnared his victims. This is why we know that teen boys had easy access to booze, weed, and porn at Gacy's home, that he'd use his position of authority and respectability, that clout, to molest the boys, then weaponize that same authority and respectability to prevent many of the surviving victims from speaking out. And these were, by and large, children, many of whom knew that something very wrong had happened to them, but who were ashamed by the attacks and afraid to seek help. So some of the stuff that I had been seeing was Gacy describing how he would kind of like talk somebody into some sexual behavior. And some of the surviving victims also described how he would approach and make a suggestive comment or move, and they might react in a way that indicated that they didn't want that, and he would play it off as, oh, I was just joking. I was just joking. Why do you take so seriously? But when he's successful, you know, if he's pressuring, he's using all of his, like, he wasn't very tall, but he was, like, kind of big. And it's telling that you thought he was in his 40s. He lived kind of rough.
He did.
He looked older than his 30 to 36 years. But he's talking kids into giving him a blowjob or accepting a blowjob. And when they are successfully manipulated, they feel complicit.
Yeah.
Right. So revisiting Midwestern Nice in a culture where negative things at the level of the smell of death in a neighbor's home are just not spoken about, you know that children are not being raised to advocate for themselves. They just don't have the tools to do it. And you need to have a good communication and problem-solving skills modeled for you as a kid. There's just no way that any of these kids were going to speak up for themselves.
Yeah, this is what Gacy would call his bisexual talk, right?
Yeah.
And what he's trying to do is trying to make this argument that, well, maybe you're bisexual, right? Maybe you do like this too, right? Like, it's not that big of a deal, right? Mm-hmm. And what he's trying to do in that situation is he has learned how to gradually manipulate someone into basically coercing them into a sexual act. This brings us into another point, which is that the idea of being a teenager and having your sexual experience, whether it be your first or whatever number of sexual experience with a significantly older person, is definitely not something unheard of in the gay community. And there's actually some research to back this up. It's really hard to get real numbers, obviously, right? But one study found that about 30% of gay men under the age of 17 had their first sexual experience with someone at least 5 years older than them. And I don't know how exactly this mirrors the heterosexual experience, but anecdotally, many, many men that I know had their first sexual experience with another man who was substantially older than them. And I want this to make sense to people because this isn't necessarily a situation where people are being actively preyed upon, right? This is also a situation where when you're a gay teenager in a place where your sexuality is being repressed, you don't have the opportunity to seek out sexual experimentation with people your age because you don't know who they are yet, right? Mm-hmm. I think this is the reason why that movie Love, Simon was so important to so many people, because it was an expression of a gay teenager finding another gay teenager, right? And that journey is something that up until the current technology age that we have today has been completely impossible. So put yourself in the shoes of that gay teenager. You're seeking out a sexual experience because as part of your normal sexual development, you are trying to figure out who you are as a sexual being, right? But because you are not heterosexual, you can't do the necking and, I guess, petting. You know, but you can't start. There are basically no bases now, right?
Right.
Because you're not able to kind of mature sexually at the same rate as everyone else, right? Because who you're going to be seeking out? You're going to be seeking out people that you know are gay or that proposition you, right? And that's where we have the danger really happen, right? So from this study, about 50% of the respondents who said that they had had a sexual experience with someone significantly older than them Half of them said that those sexual experiences were negative, coercive, and or abusive. But here's the kicker. Many didn't know it at the time. Why? Yep. Because when you're at that age, again, you're trying to experiment, right? You might be going over just because you want to hold hands and kiss, right? Mm-hmm. You don't know, though, that this person, they're well beyond that first base, right? And they're going to want to do things with you that you don't even know are beyond what you should be doing at that age, because no one has sat you down and explained it to you, right? And I think I see this in some ways. I think that the technological age and being able to access each other, you know, through like social media has improved things. In other ways, I think it's made it worse, right? Mm-hmm. Because I see gay teenagers being very much influenced by, you know, online porn culture, right? And assuming that all sex is Pornhub sex, right? And that it's okay to go from 0 to 100, right? But as we know as adults, right, going from 0 to 100 is extremely dangerous because you're not in control of what's happening. And a lot of times you end up in situations that where you are extremely vulnerable and you have no idea how you got there, right?
Well, no, it's worse. You don't know how to get out.
Amen. Amen.
Now, you mentioned in our prior episode that Gacy was an active cruiser, and obviously he wasn't killing everyone he picked up for sex, but he was absolutely developing a reputation in Chicago's gay community. Some victims of rape and torture even filed police reports against Gacy, but those investigations went nowhere because Gacy had been so successful at maintaining his public facade. The police were noticeably uncomfortable handling rape allegations when the victim and attacker were both male. So when Gacy pointed to his photo with First Lady Carter and his positions of nominal authority in the community, like organizing the Polish Constitution Day parade, and he insisted that the sex was consensual, even when the victim was obviously underage, the police basically said, "Sorry to bother you, have a nice day," and closed the case.
Yeah, I definitely think this is because this was happening so much at that time, right?
Yeah.
Gacy was definitely not the only 40-year-old, or he wasn't even 40, I keep on doing this. He was definitely not the only 36-year-old out there doing this, right? And we can't think of Gacy as an isolated situation. That's probably our number one mistake when we talk about serial killers, right? Is that we think of them as being this isolated incident, this outlier, right, as opposed to something that has been actively constructed by our community, right, and that will happen again. You know, so gay people didn't just appear out of nowhere, right?
What?
At least since the age of Greek pottery, we've been around, you know? So this must have been happening at such a high rate that I'm assuming that the police were just like, fuck it, we don't want to know. This is beyond kind of the normal homophobia that was also happening at that time as well, right? But I'm under the assumption that police at that time were probably fielding a lot of calls like this, and that they had learned, because, you know, policing is like any other industry, right? They're going to try to manage their resources in the way that's going to benefit them the most, right? Not society. Yeah. It's going to benefit them, right? So they realize that they're going to get the most amount of benefit to themselves when they're chasing crimes that are going to give them some kind of notoriety, or they're going to give them some sense what's the word I'm looking for here?
Maybe accomplishment.
There you go, right?
Yeah, and like a tragic part is that if the police had done some digging, they would have discovered that Gacy was still on parole for the 1968 conviction in Iowa. So where was Gacy trolling when he wasn't victimizing his employees or picking up someone at the Greyhound station? We know that he at least frequented one dive bar called the L&L Tavern.
Yeah, L&L Tavern is an institution. It's a place that both Meredith and I have been to independently, because both of our morbid interests led us there in a weird synchronistic way. But L&L Tavern is located in a place of Chicago that's been in transition for the past 30 odd years. And we're going to go a little bit into this because I think, again, we want to paint the picture of where Gacy was, because this gives us more insight into how he operated and also gives a little bit more context as to how Chicago as a city interacted with Gacy. So, Meredith, you want to talk a little bit about what a tavern is for those of our listeners who think that we're using some type of Renaissance fair talk and think that there's going to be some wenches in there?
No wenches, unfortunately. So tavern is a specific kind of liquor license that you can get in Chicago, and it's old. It is an old type of bar. I don't know the exact legal specifics, but essentially you're getting your food and your alcohol mm-hmm. in this place. And we have a really rich history of taverns and tavern culture in Chicago, and they were everywhere in the middle of the 20th century. Many were ethnically divided because the neighborhoods were ethnically divided. So if you came over from the old country and you're settled in the neighborhood where everybody speaks your language and looks like you, everybody in the local tavern also spoke your language, looked mm-hmm. like you. And that's where your networking circle was. You'd find your job at the tavern, right? Now, the culture was still very rich in the middle of the 20th century, so we're talking about the 50s. That's also when our first Mayor Daley, Richard J. Daley, started to draw down the number of tavern licenses that the city would grant. He saw the taverns as dens of vice, and later, in the 80s, his son, Richard M. Daley, would continue to draw down tavern licenses. But there's this middle ground here in the 70s. Neighborhood bars were still plentiful in Chicago and distinct.
Yeah.
The L&L Tavern is a dive bar where Gacy hung out in the 70s. It hasn't moved, but today it's located just south of today's Boys Town area. In the 70s, the Gold Coast was more of the Boys Town area. So although the tavern hasn't moved, the gay community really has.
Yeah.
And the Gold Coast, as we mentioned in the last episode, was the center of the gay community in the 70s. So the area where the L&L Tavern is has historically been kind of an area with a punk, metal, goth, alternative vibe, or at least it was until very recently.
Yeah.
We grew up listening to the radio and hearing the local advertisement for a store called The Alley. And the tagline there was, Clark and Belmont, if you dare.
Yeah, I know this spot because I used to hang out there when I was a teenager. Because I was a little bit of a punk. And I had a 1981 Buick Century, which was a boat of a car. But I used to drag it down there with my friends. And we would go to Punkin' Donuts, which is what they used to call the Dunkin' Donuts there. Because the parking lot was a meeting point for all of the punk, aggro, skinhead community. There's actually a really interesting book called American Skin that's about the skinhead community of Chicago, and it centers around this corner of Belmont and Clark. I don't want to go too much into like a Neil Gaiman, American Gods thing here, but there's some weird energy at that corner because so much has happened there. It is definitely a weird draw for people to come to, especially a certain type of person. Something that we'll go into later is that L&L Tavern was also the bar that Dahmer used to go to. But let's explain a little bit about why this tavern is such a unique place to go to and seems so fitting for someone like Gacy to go to. As Meredith said, this is a little bit outside of the traditional gay community. At that time, it was in the Gold Coast. But even for Boys Town, it's outside of the community. It's in the outskirts. So the type of population that it's going to draw is the type of person that is... Your presence at the bar means that you're probably into something, but you're not willing to say what it is, right? And that's because you're on the periphery of, you know, this kind of area that is traditionally, you know, seen as being LGBT. And the reason why someone like Gacy wouldn't want to go to an LGBTQ bar is because, A, they weren't really in existence yet. So like we talked about before, the Chicago gay political movement didn't really start until 1968 with the Democratic Convention, and the first bar to successfully be able to obtain a license for same-sex dancing didn't occur until 1970. So these are still very progressive places, right? And Gacy obviously doesn't want to go into one of them because, as many of you know from the Stonewall history, gay places were routinely targeted by police officers for raids. They did these raves because they generated a lot of revenue. They were able to shake down the owners of those bars for exorbitant fines. They were also able to arrest a large number of people, meeting quotas, right? And they're usually able to shake down patrons as well who wanted to be able to get out of the arrest because they knew that being having a police record saying that you were at a gay bar would ruin your life, right? So this was a really convenient way for you as a Chicago police officer, not making a lot of money, to be able to, you know, scrounge up some dollars in a very quick way. So Gacy artfully finds a place that is right outside of that. It's far away from where he lives. So for those of you who are unfamiliar, this is probably a 30-40 minute commute from where he lives to get to this bar. But he's going there specifically because it is the right intersection of being close enough to the LGBTQ community, but also far enough away so that if he's caught there, he's not going to be in quote-unquote trouble, and he's probably going to be able to see other people who are there for the same exact reason. So to just hit this point home, Gacy is going to these places because he knows that he's going to most likely encounter the type of individual that he is profiling. Someone who is like him, too scared to go to a place that is known for being LGBTQ. Also a place probably where you might be a younger person who can't go to the bars. And like we said before, in this neighborhood, there's a lot of just hanging out. So when I was a teenager and would go to this corner, we would go to that corner just to hang out, right? Just to meet each other, just to see each other, right? So L&L Tavern is right across the street from this intersection. So Gacy would probably have sat at the window and just looked to see what would be vulnerable that day, what he might be able to take home with him, which is an extremely scary thought.
And also, Bughouse Square, aka Washington Square Park, just in front of the Newberry Library in the Gold Coast area, this was a cruising zone of choice. And Jonathan, I was doing a little bit of research. I was like, first of all, to find out what Bughouse Square was.
Yeah.
Because it's not the official name.
No. That was what it was called. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Bughouse Square is interesting because it's right outside of the Gold Coast. And so it was a place for a particular type of gay encounter. You're not in the heart of it, right? And so let's say you get stopped by the police. You're not stuck in the middle of, at that time, Gold Coast, which would have been the LGBTQ area. You're right outside of it, right? So you have a very probable, you know, reason or rationale as to why you're there. So to go a little bit deeper into it, though, the reason why they called it Bughouse was because they were referring to buggery, which, if you are a fan of English slang, you know that buggery is a term for gay sex, right? And at that time, what it was being used for was a meetup spot for people to be able to meet each other for anonymous sex.
Yeah. And, of course, Gacy would sometimes simply kidnap somebody from the street.
Yeah.
One victim, Jeffrey Regnall, described getting the Gacy's car based on the offer of a ride and a joint. Mm-hmm. And you can just see that. You can just imagine that right at Clark and Belmont.
Mm-hmm.
He was immediately knocked out with a chloroform-soaked rag and taken to Gacy's home for a night of torture and rape. In the morning, Regnall woke up in Lincoln Park, and he spent 6 days in the hospital. Another survivor described being approached by what he thought was an unmarked police vehicle, being asked for his identification, then being forced into the car at gunpoint when he'd gotten closer. Gacy, the political animal, knew that young people were mostly compliant, and he was well-versed in the ways of respectable community leaders. So he'd made his car look like an unmarked police vehicle by adding some spotlights.
Yeah.
He knew how to take advantage of the respect that most people have for the appearance of authority.
Well, and Gacy also talked like a cop, right?
Yeah.
We all know that Gacy hung out with cops all the time. And so he was very well versed in the way that cops, the vernacular, the diction. And for anyone who's ever hung out with a cop, you know that there's a way that cops speak, right? Even when they're off duty, they still have like a preter argumentative stance, right? Like they're anticipating you to kind of like speak against them, right? I say this as someone with a cop in my family, right? And Gacy had that. And you hear it in his interviews. It's triggering, I think, for some people.
Mm-hmm.
And we can imagine that when he does up his car to look that way, right? That, you know, there's that initial like, oh, what's going on here? But then as soon as he starts to talk, I can totally see a normal Chicagoan response to that being like, oh, wow, this is a cop and I have to do what he says, you know?
Yeah. You think you're in trouble.
You think you're in trouble. Yeah. And Gacy knew exactly how to utilize that against someone because that's what sociopaths do, you know? Like it's the reason why this is something that we're trying to do is because we need to see what Chicago looked like for Gacy in the 70s, right? So L&L Tavern takes us to what it looks like from, you know, like that particular area, why he would go there, why it would be such a fertile, you know, hunting ground for him. But you mentioned that he takes him to Lincoln Park and leaves him there. And yes. I think that we need to also remember that when we're saying Lincoln Park, we're not talking about the same Lincoln Park of today, right? Where, you know, you are a yuppie making six figures. Back in the day, Lincoln Park was not the trendy part of Chicago. Lincoln Park was actually a area with a lot of people from, you know, lower economic backgrounds. That area, it took a very long time to gentrify. You know, there is a pattern in Chicago for gentrification. It usually starts off as a Latino neighborhood, then the gays move in, then the gays completely ruin it. And I can say this as a gay person, completely ruin it by making it very, very trendy, right? Then you start getting kind of single white females who feel comfortable living in a gay neighborhood going there. Then you have the straight men who are chasing them moving in afterwards, and then it becomes a gentrified neighborhood, right? That's the course. And Lakeview at that time was the Latino neighborhood that was in transition in the early 90s. But Lincoln Park, which is right south of there, was still a very rough area. And at that time was mostly Puerto Rican. Of course, today it's largely upper middle class and white. And one of the most expensive places to live in the whole city. But at that time, Gacy would have seen Lincoln Park as a safe place to dump a victim because white privilege, right? He knew that putting a body there would mean that the police were instantaneously going to look at the Puerto Rican population there and not think of this white dude out in the northwest suburbs. And we're going to talk a little bit about how all of this ties in together when we talk about our next murder that we're going to be covering. But white privilege is really something that needs to be highlighted here because he's taking advantage of that because he knows he's utilizing the social rules that he sees as a sociopath. As a sociopath, he can't follow them, but he knows how to manipulate them.
Yeah, well, Gacy really made a mark on Chicagoland, but it's not a topic that many of us will willingly introduce to the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a family secret. If you know, then you know. But it's not something that people are going to trot out at Thanksgiving and Christmas dinner for conversation.
Yeah.
One really tangible example is our contrasting visits to the L&L Tavern, right? So this podcast is not the first time that Jonathan and I have been talking about serial killers. And I know that's a huge shocker. But a few years ago, Jonathan went to the L&L Tavern, had a specific type of experience. And a little bit more recently, my husband and I went to the L&L Tavern and had a completely different experience. So, Jonathan, do you want to talk about yours first?
I went there with a friend of mine specifically because we knew that both Gacy and Dahmer had been there. We sat at the bar and we talked very openly about why we were there. I will say that me and this particular friend are very loud. I'm a loud person. This person grew up in an Irish-American family, so she's also extremely loud. And the bartender overheard us and came up to us, and we had this whole conversation with him about how he knew Dahmer. And he wasn't old enough to know who Gacy was, but he did remember Dahmer, and he told us exactly where Dahmer used to sit, how Dahmer used to act, and basically how Dahmer used to cruise, which was eerily similar to the reports of how Gacy did, which was at the window. And if you're ever in Chicago, you should go to L&O Tavern, because you'll see what the setup is. It's a very small dive bar, but there is a bar there's two bars at the windows, and you're sitting at stools, and there's lettering that covers up about half of the window. So it leaves this small little gap where you can kind of sit very comfortably and just stare outside at everyone walking by. It's the perfect place to be if you are a cat or if you are a psychopath. It's a way for you to retain a level of anonymity and be able to stare outside. So, you know, but we were very vocal about why we were there. So yes. I think that's what created this conversation.
When I was there, we got a table. Me being who I am, and I don't like confrontation, and I don't like to talk to strangers, even though I'm a grown-ass woman, my husband went up to the bar and ordered the beers. And he was really excited because they had all of the legacy brands. So we're talking the PBRs, the hams, all of it. So we actually just bought all of them and like lined them up and had a tasting. But that's the thing, like, we didn't instigate any conversation, and nobody instigated conversation with us. So it was really more of a mind your own business type of evening at the L&L Tavern. And so, but that is the Chicago experience. Like, if you know something has happened, like if you're in the know, then you're in the know, and you need to invite conversation, because nobody's going to introduce it to you. Well, we talked before about how the killer clown trope ratcheted up in popular culture after this, but Gacy had a few other long-lasting impacts on Chicago. He's essentially a local boogeyman.
Yeah.
Just like when your uncle and all the other police officers clamor to get close to the execution back in 94, many folks will tell you a story about John Wayne Gacy, and this is exactly borne out by your story with the bartender in L&L.
Yeah.
To this day, reporters seek out jailhouse guards for firsthand accounts of Gacy, thereby prolonging the 15 minutes of fame for anybody who got close to that killer clown. Mm-hmm. In the O'Hare neighborhood of Chicago, the house on Summerdale Avenue was demolished in 1979, but the empty lot remained a local attraction for years. Teens would sneak onto the vacant lot to drink late at night. Eventually, a new house was built on the property, and now, over 40 years later, people like us are still drawn to the area, and neighbors can spot the looky-loos from a mile away.
Oh, yeah.
On a weird note, immediately after the execution, rumors circulated about Gacy's brain being kept for study. And as it turns out, those rumors were true.
Damn.
Yes. Doctor...
That's because you know what? I feel like I heard that too.
Yeah, you did, because it happened.
Shit. Okay, wow. Okay. Yeah.
So this person called Dr. Helen Morrison, she's a Chicago-based forensic psychiatrist who built a reputation around serial murderer expertise. Mm-hmm. And she occasionally appears on the local news when an area serial killer is caught. So if there's something in Northwest Indiana or like Wisconsin, she's on the news in Chicago.
Yeah.
So Dr. Morrison studied Gacy's brain and apparently stores it in her basement. So there's some Chicago lore for you.
There you go. Yeah.
Yep. In our last episode, we talked about the end of Gacy and Carol's sexual relationship and how she'd witnessed him bringing teen boys to the garage, probably picking some of them up at Bughouse Square. Others. Perhaps from L&L Tavern. This, of course, led to their divorce in 1975, But what we didn't mention is that Carol would come back to the house to co-host parties for the neighborhood. Even though she knew he was having sex with underage boys, also known as statutory rape, keeping up appearances was evidently more important. And we should also note that being openly gay at this time was basically an open invitation to get fired from your job and to be outcast from your community. It was directly at odds with Gacy's carefully constructed mainstream public life, and my guess is it would likely have had some bad consequences for Carol as well to be associated with him. And remember, the neighbors knew the house smelled bad. They were all too happy to accept Gacy's claims of poor drainage, or later, of having dead rats under the house, as an explanation. Jonathan, you mentioned that the neighbors knew that Gacy was a little off in our last episode.
Mm-hmm.
And I found this amazing description of Gacy's personality from a journalist whose name is Alex Wilkinson. He'd interviewed Gacy for The New Yorker shortly before the execution in 94. Occasionally, his company was so dreary that I would take off my watch so I couldn't see how slowly the time was passing. Now and then, he struck me as being like a bore you start a conversation with in a bar and then realize you can't get rid of.
That sounds definitely on point.
That is on point. That's why, you know, I went to L&L Tavern and I didn't talk to anybody. So I guess the point that we're trying to make here is that, yes, Chicago helped to form Gacy into the monster that he was. But Chicago also helped Gacy to get away with raping, torturing, and killing young men and teenage boys throughout the 70s. First, Carol looked the other way. Then the neighbors looked the other way. And finally, the police looked the other way.
Yeah, everyone's looking away. And even at the very end, when he's finally, and I know we're going to get now into the capturing of Gacy, but this process was not a quick process. He was under surveillance for what seemed like forever and became friends with the cops that were actually doing the surveillance. I think that one of the things that I think is interesting about your quotation from Alec Wilkinson is that it seems that Alec probably is a normal human being because...
Maybe, yeah.
And I'm saying this only because it seems very much in direct opposition to what cops used to think of Gacy, which is that cops loved Gacy.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a really great documentary right now on Peacock. And what was so startling was that you hear these reports from normal people saying, like, yeah, I couldn't fucking stand him. But cops seem to have gotten a kick out of him. And he really seemed to have created a shtick that worked really well with law enforcement that made him very, very palatable to them. Because all of them said he just seemed like I can't do the Chicago accent, but pretend I'm doing a really great Chicago accent when I say this, that he just seemed like a really great guy. And, you know, we just hung out with him. He used to buy us beers. We got him beers, etc. So this process of being captured takes a very long time because the process of looking away is not just a passive looking away. It's an intentional looking away.
Yeah. And by 1978, after getting away with murdering at least 32 boys and young men, Gacy must have felt invincible. The cops were his fucking buddies.
Mm-hmm.
He's a good old Chicago boy. Ever since he left Iowa behind, no accusations of abduction, rape, and torture could stick to him. His mainstream public life had been the perfect shield, and even after his second marriage fell apart, his ex-wife continued to support the facade of having a great marriage. He had even killed the son of one of his neighbors, the 18-year-old son of a Chicago police sergeant, and suffered no consequences.
Yeah.
So when he abducted 15-year-old Robert Peast from the parking lot of the pharmacy where Peast worked, Gacy simply didn't worry about the details. And finally, that's why he was caught. Peast wasn't easily dismissed as a runaway. He told his mother that he was going to see a building contractor about a summer job and then disappeared. And Gacy was known in the area, particularly for hiring teen boys for summer contracting jobs, and so the connection was made. Eventually, Gacy was put under surveillance, but he treated it like a joke, and he chummed around with the officers as though they were his bodyguards. He was wielding his shield of good old Chicago uncle as hard as he could, but he made a critical error. He invited those officers into his home to use the bathroom. The smell of decomposing human flesh was what the officers needed to obtain a search warrant, which was then executed on December 21st of 1978. For the next several days, the police excavated the remains of 29 victims from the Gacy property. News crews, neighbors, and even parents of missing boys from across the Chicagoland area gathered in front of that house to watch. Some of the parents even brought their missing son's dental records to the police, which did result in some successful identifications. And hold on to that for a minute, because we'll come back to this.
Just looking at this objectively, Iowa got him, okay?
They did.
When he was in Iowa, he wasn't even doing this to this level, but it was enough to be able to arrest him and put him in jail. Mm-hmm. But in Chicago, we can't do that because of the fact that he was able to speak the type of Chicago political slash cop speak that he needed to be able to get out of it. In almost any other place of the country, okay, he probably would not have gotten away with this, because what was shielding him was the Polish, the Catholic, the political, that he was able to use as those shields to keep from getting caught.
All right. Remember the Gaber's Block that happened in December of 1978 when the police were pulling the remains of Gacy's victims out from the house? There were a bunch of parents in that crowd wondering if their missing kid might be in there. A lot of teenage boys had gone missing in the 70s, and they still do. Police still consider many of these missing children to be runaways. And let's face it, there is a lot of reasons for a teenager to leave home and cut contact with their family.
Well, Gacy did it himself, right?
He did.
At 18, runs away from home, goes to Las Vegas, sleeps with a corpse, and then comes back home.
It's essentially, aside from the corpse thing, totally normal.
Yes.
But the crowd in front of 8213 West Summerdale Avenue contained a bunch of parents who knew their kids better than the police and who were sure that their sons hadn't just left home and set up a new life somewhere else. And because some of those missing children were in fact recovered from Gacy's property, some identified through dental records back in the 70s, and others identified through DNA investigation in recent years, it fueled an ongoing rumor in Chicagoland that maybe there were more victims that haven't been found yet.
Yeah.
Have you heard this?
I have, and I know we're going to get into one of his dumping spots, which I've been out to, and I don't think that he just used it for a couple of bodies.
Okay.
But we'll get into that.
I want to hear about it. Okay. Yeah. So some locals believe that there are more bodies buried on the property where Gacy's mother used to live, an apartment building about 4 miles west of the Summerdale house. And they've been doing their own investigative work since 2011. They're pushing for the yard area of that property to be excavated and searched for human remains. Is that the property that you were talking about?
No, I know that property. Ooh. Going back, Gacy originally had his sister and his mom both living at that Summerdale house.
Yeah.
Then he moves them out shortly before he marries Carol.
Yeah.
I believe it's because he was kind of engaging in the sexual cruising that he knew his sister and his mom were kind of catching wind of. So he moves them into a different house and then moves Carol in. So I think that that's that window, but he didn't move them far away. So this is that house. But we'll continue.
Okay. I was looking at Google Maps because I was like, all right, well, how far away is like his mom's apartment and what's going on? And and then after the crawl space was filled up, he said he was disposing of remains in the Des Plaines River. So I'm just like, I'm on Google Maps looking at all of this. And so one thing that really stuck out for me was just by looking at the map of the O'Hare neighborhood area, I thought it was really weird that Gacy hid victims in that crawl space.
Yeah.
And then the river, because there's a forest preserve less than a mile from the Summerdale home. Like, why wouldn't he just use that?
Which, incidentally, is part of the forest preserve that Dugan would leave a victim many years later, who just to bring us back full circle here, is also someone who claims that he was sexually assaulted by Gacy. So I know exactly what this dumping spot is. If you go on the I-55, right, which some people call the Stevenson, if you go on the Stevenson and you're going out towards Joliet, right after you hit Joliet, there's a cross with the 80. There is, that's where the Des Plaines River kind of crosses through. And he dumped bodies in that river. I've never understood why. It's so far away from where he is. And so it just seems so weird that he would chance having a body in his car.
The whole way.
And also, there's a smell that would have contaminated that car. So it seems to me that they just know about that spot because it's probably a place where a body came up and that they were able to kind of, you know, connect it to him. There has to be more spots.
Yeah. Well, the Des Plaines River, yes, he used the bridge over I-55, but the Des Plaines River flows all the way up to that forest preserve that's a mile away from the Somerdale House.
Yeah.
It just doesn't make any sense. But, okay, this is where, like, I gotta calm down. Because, there's fuel for speculation, but we need to be careful not to let Gacy become a legend.
100%.
Yes, there may be additional victims that have not yet been recovered. But we can be reasonably sure that most or all of Gacy's victims have been found and laid to rest in a respectful manner. And that with ongoing efforts to identify the John Does through DNA, that one day all of them will be identified.
Yeah, I think that the speculation ends up going into a really dangerous place with serial killer worship, where people start to kind of make them out to be, you know, what Nietzsche called the Übermensch, right? Mm-hmm. That these are now kind of superhuman. And that's a really dangerous place for any of us to be. So with Gacy, you know, I know I'm guilty of this as well, of speculating like, oh, maybe there are more bodies. But I think it's much better for us to think of it in the way that you've laid out, which is that we found the majority of the bodies. He's not an Übermensch, right? And if there are more bodies out there, it's because, you know, it's not because he's smarter than everyone else. It's because we just haven't found them yet, right? It's not because he, you know, has masterminded some kind of crazy plot that only he knows, right?
That's exactly it. He wasn't a mastermind. He was just a sick fuck.
Yeah.
All right. So to bring this story to a close, Gacy spent about 13 years imprisoned in downstate Illinois at Menard, trying to make a name for himself by selling clown paintings and keeping up a lot of correspondence. Ultimately, his legal appeals failed, and in May of 1994, he was transferred to Stateville in Joliet, Illinois, and executed by lethal injection. Even though the execution was carried out just after midnight, a huge crowd of people gathered outside the prison to cheer and celebrate the end of Gacy's story.
And then my uncle woke me up with the free tacos he got afterwards.
Full circle.
What a fucking ride, okay? Like you said before, this is not the first time, nor is it the last time that we have had a conversation about serial killers, but I always enjoy hearing your take on things because it opens my eyes to new aspects I just haven't thought about before. But we're going to continue next week with another serial killer that's not actually one person. It's a concert. They are the infamous Ripper Crew. The reason why we're talking about this next is because Robin Gecht, who many people believe is the ringleader, actually used to work for Gacy. And so we are completing basically a sick triangle of shitty, shitty white men. And to Kevin Bacon chain this, as people used to do back in the day, Dugan, who we started off with, claims to have been sexually assaulted by Gacy. Gacy was a contractor and employed Robin Gecht. And Robin Gecht took three guys and set forth on a series of crimes that resulted in the deaths of 18 women, and which were deemed as satanic, necrophilic, and cannibalistic by the media. This story is insane. And we have here what I would call the beginnings of the satanic panic, because we're still in the 80s. And we're not really going to gear up to the full satanic panic until the 90s. But this kind of sets us up. But what we're also going to see in this conversation is that the media could not deal with these details. And so they eventually chose to ignore it for the cleaner and more palatable story of the Tylenol killer. But the reason why this is important is because it infuses into the consciousness of the of society some of these terms that have not been heard before, right? And it really sets us up for the 90s when we go full satanic panic and the really horrible consequences of that. So with that, join us next time as we finish off this triumvirate of Chicago murder and continue our conversation about the Ripper Crew.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Murderland Chicago, A Deep Dish of Death was created and produced by us, Jonathan Sanchez-Leos and Meredith Halsey. Our theme music is The Original Chicago Blues, which was composed by James White in 1915 and performed by Katerina Storchias in 2021. Artwork is by Laura Gosdell.
Special thanks to everyone who helped make this season possible, including the friends and family who listened, gave constructive feedback, and offered advice and pointers on recording and editing. And thank you for listening. If you'd like to hear more from us, subscribe to Murderland Chicago, A Deep Dish of Death on your podcast app. Follow us on Patreon at Murderland Chicago, and find us on Instagram at Deep Dish of Death.
Throughout the making of this podcast, we did quite a bit of research to ensure that the information we are sharing is accurate, but we know that sometimes information sources contain errors, and we accept that, in conversation, we may have introduced errors to the stories. To that point, this podcast is for entertainment purposes only. Please send any comments, suggestions, or correction of errors to us at deepdishofdeath@gmail.com.